Thank you. Thanks, Bernadine. It's been my fate and good fortune to live in the reflected glory of this brave and good woman for 37 years, almost 40. So, I will simply echo a couple of things, and then let's have a conversation. A word about Mecca. Ian McEwan, the great British novelist who's probably best known for his book Atonement, wrote a small novel years ago that I like very much called Enduring Love, and I first encountered it in short stories in The New Yorker. It begins with a scene that's absolutely compelling. A couple in celebrating a reunion is having a picnic in a park in London, and it's a beautiful summer day, breezy, sunny, and a hot air balloon is coasting along and attempts a landing in the park, and it's pastoral, it's beautiful, until it suddenly turns bad. The lines get tangled. It's clearly an old man, perhaps a grandfather, and a young child, and they are suddenly in peril. And a group of people from all over the park, as they hear the screams of alarm, begin running towards the balloon. And the narrator gets there just in time to grab one of the docking lines, as have maybe a dozen others, just as a gust comes along and lifts the balloon up into the air. And the narrator says at that point, if we just had time to get organized, if we had just had time to coordinate our efforts, perhaps we could have helped. But we didn't have time, and we didn't have a leader. And someone, I don't think it was me, let go of the rope and dropped back to earth, and the balloon rushed upward, and then another dropped, and then another. And the balloon went on into the distance towards high power lines and peril. That sense of grabbing onto the docking lines, grabbing onto the lifelines, and holding on no matter how much it hurts, and getting organized in order to do it, comes to mind thinking of Mecca. They're asking us to grab the lifelines and to be in coordination with them to save the children and to save the planet, really, but to start by being very concrete and intervening and saving people who are at imminent risk. We really are at a magical confluence, and I want to try to name the moment and just build on a couple of things Bernadine said. We were happily in the park in Grant Park, Chicago, on November 4th, 2008. It was an amazing moment to be there, an amazing place to be. First of all, because while we've been in a lot of large crowds in our lives, we've never been in a large crowd that wasn't edged with anger or demand or drunkenness or gluttony. And this was a large crowd powered by relief, without a doubt, relief that we were turning a page or that we might be turning a page with hope, with love, with a sense of celebration that still kind of echoes inside of us, a sense that, I don't know, that the time of war and divisiveness and insanity and invasion might be eased up a little bit. The moment of yes, we can was upon us, and everybody felt it that night. And everyone also felt a sense of yes, we can what? It wasn't automatic that yes, we can anything. Yes, we can what? What can we do? And for, I think, each of us, and we ran into an amazing number of people, an amazing number of friends. There were a million people there, but we kept running into people, and everyone would burst into tears. And I couldn't stop crying when I found the place 40 years prior that I had been beaten bloody and dragged off to jail during the 68 convention. So, I mean, to think 40 years later, and here we were in the same park, in the same way, same people in some ways, and what an exciting moment. And as Bernadine said, something that was unthinkable 2 years prior was suddenly inevitable. And it's true, that notion, the first African-American president, a generational shift, boy, is it about time. Let the old people get off the stage. Not us, of course, but I'm just meaning the rest of them. No, really, there's something important about the generational shift. And the sense that Bernadine mentioned about having a community organizer, somebody who, you can't think of another president in history who would have been comfortable knocking on the doors of people on the South Side, going in and sharing a cup of coffee in a public housing kitchen. You can't think of another president. And this man did that for years. So There's something to hold on to there. There's something to wonder about. There's something to build on, something to push. But of course, he's not a savior and he won't save us. In fact, it's been said, and I think it's worth repeating, that Barack Obama can't save the country, but we could save Barack Obama. And that's a very different way of thinking about it. I think in the worlds that we live in, the worlds we care about, the world of juvenile justice, the world of education, the world of building a peace movement, we get a little bit nervous when, especially progressives who are by nature political junkies, have no polls to read anymore. And so they kind of read the tea leaves outside the White House as if the redemption somehow is there. As Peter pointed out to me, actually, we still have Minnesota to hold on to. So there's still something to obsess about. But the truth is that that in many ways we look in the wrong direction when we look exclusively at the new administration. And the greater challenge is to look at ourselves. What have we done today? What are we building? How are we transforming ourselves? How are we organizing? How are we building a movement? The other thing that I just want to note also is that the magic confluence is not only the 44th president is African-American, not only that we're 40 years from 1968, but we also just celebrated the 80th anniversary of the birth of Martin Luther King. And so it's worth noting these things, and everyone has, noting these things as things that are happening together, things that are, the confluences are together. So let's remember the radical king for one moment. Let's remember, am I breaking up? Ah! What happened? You okay?
Yeah.
I want to make sure you're okay. It's like worrying about your surgeon if he's had enough to eat and so on. I want to think about the Martin Luther King who talked about the fierce urgency of now. Tomorrow is today, and today is almost yesterday. And then Martin Luther King, who urged us to move past indecision to action, and who wrote, "Shall we say the odds are too great? We must choose in this critical moment." And think of his last book, "Where Do We Go From Here? Chaos or Community?" And that really is, it seems to me, the moment that we're living in. Rising expectations, which can be a very good thing, coupled with an enduring and serious and abiding financial, economic crisis, and perhaps linked to that and more serious than either, a sense that the United States empire of the last 50 years is ending. The wonderful Randy Newman song where he says, "The end of the empire is messy at best, and this one is ending like all the rest." And it's true. And that can be, that does not have to be the occasion for sadness and misery. That can be an occasion for real celebration and happiness if we get it right. And the way to get it right is to build the political will not to move out of this crisis into war, as we did at the end of the crisis of the 30s and 40s, but move out of this crisis into rebuilding the world, rebuilding ourselves, and taking control of ourselves so that we can rebuild education, healthcare, infrastructure. These things are what we need, and these are the things that are being given lip service to. We have to find a way to create the political will so that that's the choice that we make, not the choice for war and imprisonment and incarceration and surveillance and all the rest. It's our choice. So where do we go from here? Chaos or community? I think that I want to talk a minute about movement building. It seems to me that this is a great moment of movement making, and Bernadine and I have been involved for the last several years in Chicago with a group called the Movement Making Group. And our thought is this, that while a movement cannot be willed into being, you can't just say, "I want it, therefore it will be," the mistake of the weatherman, but rather to think that even though we can't will it into being, nor can we wait patiently for it to come into being, and then we know exactly what we'll do. We'll be with the good guys and we'll join in. Remember the decades prior to 1954, prior to 1956 and the Civil Rights Movement, the amount of organizing, the amount of educating, the attempts, but something happened, and these are unpredictable things that happen. Something happened where enough people began to believe that there is an alternative. And then they were willing to take great risks on behalf of that alternative. The thesis that we have to defeat is sometimes people have referred to it as the Tina thesis. There is no alternative. If there is no alternative, why would you possibly take a risk? Why would you go register to vote in Mississippi if it won't take you anywhere? Why should you risk your life? But when it became obvious to a large number of people that there is an alternative, that a possibility exists, as the World Social Forum says, that another world is possible, well, at that point, we're all willing to get in line and do the right thing. But this is a period where there's not an obvious linked-up social movement, but there are things to do. And there are things that we must do if we hope to participate in a large, wild, diverse, democratic social movement that will bring fundamental social change to the United States. And that, it seems to me, the things we can do, and what we're trying to do in this group in Chicago, first, we can learn to talk to one another. We can learn through dialogue. And I think we sometimes, as progressives, as radicals, we underestimate the value of that. We can learn to listen to one another and talk to one another. Find a language in which we actually can share a vision of where we're going. And so we spend a lot of time getting the immigrant rights people, the disability rights people, the GLBT community, the anti-war people together to talk about our common struggles. And it's obvious very quickly that war and warming are linked, and that disability rights and war are linked. And we have to see those links and come to have a conversation in which we can share one another's issues. In other words, we have to get out of the silos that are conveniently places that we dwell. Leave the silo, find the common ground. That's one very important step. So learning to talk together, it seems to me. The other thing that we have to do in this movement building moment, it seems to me, is we have to get rid of the idea that we're a minority. One of the worst things we do as progressives is think we're a minority. I know that's not as big a problem in Berkeley as it is in Chicago. In Berkeley, the problem might be that you think you already made the revolution, and therefore, no, I know you don't. I know you don't. I know you don't. But in Chicago, it's very obvious that a lot of us on the left think of ourselves as a minority, and we therefore act as a minority, instead of finding a way to develop a vocabulary that embraces the great majority that actually agrees with us. And that's the hardest thing to do. We suffer in this country, we suffer as in everywhere, but we suffer because we labor under these kind of controlling metaphors or these dominant discourses. And, you know, I could give you obvious examples, a couple of obvious examples. After 9/11, when there was a great open discussion about what had happened, and some of us were saying it was a crime against humanity, it was a pure act of terrorism, and a crime requires a criminal justice response, the noisy voices, the loud voices, and ultimately the dominant voices were saying, no, it was a war, it was a war, it was a war on terror that we have to conduct because we were attacked and it was an act of war. It was not an act of war. And as soon as you say war on terror, you find yourself in a conversation that you've already lost. And so I kept being grateful to the BBC, oddly, for saying the so-called war on terror, because it makes a difference. There is no such thing. It's a fantasy. It's a phantom. And you can't end a phantom. You can't end a metaphor. So how do you end a real war that's happened on the ground that's part of a metaphoric war that's not happening anywhere or that's happening everywhere? It's insane. So that's an example of us trying to find ways, progressives coming together, talking, trying to find ways to shift the metaphor. What Bernadine was referring to in foreign policy, away from a foreign policy that believes that safety and our place in the world is somehow guaranteed through violence and through invasion and through occupation, and coming to a place where we believe that we are a nation among nations, not the uber nation, but one among many, a people among people that respects other people. And can we get there? Can we find a way to get there without going through the furnace of war? This is what I mean by kind of changing the dominant discourse and finding a language that embraces others. Oddly to us, because we've lived our whole adult lives on the left, we find ourselves in Chicago where we're in the majority on our 10 most important issues. I mean, the City Council of Chicago is against the Patriot Act, is against nuclear weapons, is for gay marriage. I mean, good God, you know, how could that be? We're supposed to have our precious little left-wing ideas, but it turns out The city council agrees with us. So why don't we shift that discussion and find a way to embrace everybody? End our sense of a minority, defeat the Tina hypothesis, get out of our bunkers. And the other thing, to sum all that up, is to go see the movie Milk, which I hope wins every award. What's great about Milk, besides the performance of Sean Penn, if you haven't seen it, is that it opens with the credits, and we see arrests of men in bars and the shaming of those men in our adult lifetime, and yet it seems like centuries ago that happened. And so you see a metaphor shifting before our eyes. You see something that's grown. The other thing you see is Harvey Milk, the agitator, the organizer, and Harvey Milk as defeated, and then defeated again, and then defeated again, and in the end, murdered. And in some ways, this film is his rising again, even through that final defeat. That's what we have to understand. It's not the arc of our activist lives is not some wonderful, sunshiny path. It's a path of struggle, and it's a path of sacrifice. And then it's a path of, one hopes, rising again. And I think you have to see the film because Harvey Milk rises again in the film. I think it's very important. So a simple rhythm to what I'm advocating, a simple rhythm. You cannot be a good citizen, you can't be a participant in a democracy, you can't be an activist unless you're willing to open your eyes and to see the world as it is, the joy, the ecstasy, the pleasure, the wonder of it all, but also the pain and the unnecessary suffering. And wherever you see the pain and the unnecessary suffering, we have a responsibility to act. We have to act against it. But opening our eyes is the first step. It's a critical first step. I think, for example, of the Brazilian movie from a decade ago, Central Station, about a woman who writes letters for illiterates in the Central Station of Rio de Janeiro. And one day a man comes to her and says, Dora, I want you to take the day off and go to this address in Rio and take this boy from here to this other address where an American couple will adopt him. And I'll pay you $100. Well, who could object? So she goes and the next day and she takes the boy from place to place. She gets $100 on her way home. She buys a television set. And she's sitting in her humble home looking at the TV when a neighbor comes over and she tells the neighbor the story. And the neighbor says, Dora, and this all happens in the first few minutes of the film. The neighbor says, Dora, are you crazy? You didn't take a boy to be adopted. You took a boy to be sold onto the international market for organs. He's been killed probably by now, and his organs distributed. And of course, we as an audience and Dora as a participant is horrified, and the rest of the film is her attempt to save the boy. There was no moral issue, there was no ethical issue when she first took the contract and did the job. The moral issue comes when her eyes are open. The ethical demand comes when she sees what she's done. And we are all, in a sense, living in a state of denial or seeing partially. And we know that's kind of the human condition. But we can and we must, in this moment, open our eyes to the injustices that exist and then, like Dora, go on a path of repair, try to find out how to solve that problem, how to work that issue. And then the third step is we have to doubt. We have to open our eyes, we have to act, and then we have to doubt, by which I mean rethink, reconsider, reimagine, and then act again. Without the doubting, we become self-righteous and we become sectarian and dogmatic. And I've been there and I understand that. But without the willingness to act, we also become cynical and self-satisfied and also self-righteous. It's that combination of opening our eyes, acting, and then doubting. So this is a life of activism. This is the peace movement we need to build right now, right here. We need to build it against this surge into Afghanistan, which will be the end of this administration. We need to build it in Palestine and help this administration move in the right direction in Palestine. We need to build it throughout the world. The United States is the cause. King said the greatest purveyor of violence on earth. It's much truer today than when he said it 40 years ago. We are the greatest purveyor of violence on earth. We must end the violence, and we as citizens are responsible for that. How do we live this life of activism? Just to end with a wonderful observation by the great Rosa Luxemburg, who wrote to a friend from prison who asked her for advice about how to live her life. And Luxemburg wrote, My simple advice to you is to be a mensch. And then she said, I can't really define mensch for you except to say that it means simply to love your own life enough to take care of your children and the elders, to enjoy a good meal, to welcome the sunshine and be in awe of the sunset. Every day, love your own life, and to love the world enough to put your shoulder on history's wheel when history demands it. And she said, it's that combination that makes you a mensch. Love yourself and love the world. Thanks very much.
So let's just get up together. Oh, you want to make a pitch? Yeah.